Good afternoon. Welcome to Line One, your health connection, originating from Anchorage, Alaska Public Media in Anchorage, Alaska. I'm your host, Dr. Thad Woodard. John Patrick is my guest, and he has taken 35 years of experience in technology, which concluded as IBM's Vice President of Technology, and combined it with a doctor in health administration and experience as a board member of a teaching hospital. Out of this combination has come his book, Health Attitude, Unraveling and Solving the Complexities of Healthcare. Here he enumerates many of the problems with our current healthcare system and suggests that a switch to a value-based system rewarding health and not illness, that is a new attitude, is the ticket to a more affordable, more accessible, more effective healthcare delivery system. He's joining us today by telephone from Connecticut. John Patrick, welcome to Line One.
Well, thank you, Dr. Woodard. It's nice to be here.
During this next hour, those of you who are listening, please try to reach out with us to us with your questions and comments. A couple of ways to do that. Our local number, 550-8433, 550-8433. Our toll-free number, 1-888-353-5752. And our email address is line1@alaskapublic.org. Well, John, let's start. What induced you, for heaven's name, to leave IBM and technology and enter into the healthcare field?
Well, after 35 years at IBM, I just felt that was enough. I had done my fair share. I enjoyed it thoroughly. I was quite involved in the beginnings of the web. I was a founder of the World Wide Web Consortium, one of the co-founders, or a group of us, at MIT back in 1994. So after all that time, I decided it was time to move on and do other things, and I joined a number of boards when I retired. This was 14 years ago, and one of those boards was a teaching community hospital in Connecticut, and I have to say it was a real eye-opener. You know, on the one hand, I saw this marvelous institution with deep roots in the community since 1885 and wonderful nurses and great surgeons and just a great thing. But on the other hand, I saw an organization that was so far behind, not any more than most hospitals, but just really coming from the world of the web where you click and something happens. I found myself in a world where there was no place to click. So I got quite interested in healthcare. I went back to school at age 65. I earned a doctorate in health administration and did some research and wrote a dissertation. And then I wrote this book, Health Attitude, as you mentioned. My goal there simply is to share what I learned and help more people understand what our healthcare system is all about, what's wrong with it, and how to fix it.
Well, there's no question that the technology was way ahead of healthcare. You know, the banks were going online. We could do all kinds of things quickly. Everybody knew where you were in the world. People could look up their balance. They could get money. And only recently has last five or ten years have the internet usability of healthcare come into its own. I was kind of an early adopter, and I thought I could see it coming. My understanding is there was never the protocol set up. The government never, or whoever, somebody, I assumed it was the government, set up the protocols which would allow safety of internet communication among physicians and patient information was the problam. Am I wrong about that, or was there some other issues that caused all that delay?
No, that's true. I mean, there was really no thought given to a lot of things about information technology in healthcare. The most amazing thing to me, coming from a background of the internet, is, you know, when you think about it, the internet works exactly the same everywhere in the world, exactly the same. Credit cards work the same everywhere in the world. But in healthcare, you can go into the ER, they'll collect a lot of data about you, put it in an electronic medical record, but then if you get transferred to the operating room for surgery, they can't read the data from the ER. This is even within the same hospital. So there are no standards like the internet and like credit cards. There are no standards to allow the transfer of information. It's really far behind.
Were are you able to say whether this country was further behind than other countries, or was this a somewhat universal problem?
No, unfortunately, we're behind other countries. Denmark is the poster child in healthcare. They're paperless. They have very high quality healthcare. Great outcomes. Their cost is 60-70% of our cost. That's the biggest problem, by the way, in healthcare. There are a lot of problems that we could talk all night about, but the biggest problem, without question, in my mind, is the cost. We spend almost double per person what other countries spend, and it's not because we get better health care. It's not because we have more technology in play. It's just because we have a lot of unnecessary tests and procedures.
Which is somewhat related to this lack of communication between providers and hospitals?
Exactly right. Let's suppose you're on the merry-go-round going from one specialist to another specialist to your family doctor to another specialist and so on. And a specialist decides they need some blood work. And maybe you just had some blood work ordered by the primary care physician or perhaps another specialist. But for that new specialist who wants this blood work, it's faster for them to get the data and it's easier for them to get the data by doing a new test than it is to get the data that already exists at one of those other two doctors. That's the simplest example I can think of unnecessary tests and procedures, and there are millions of them, and it adds up to a staggering amount. One study puts the unnecessary tests and procedures at $1.5 trillion per year.
So We have really, you've mentioned that we spend more. We've talked about that on this program. We've talked about that we don't, in measures, similar measures of quality throughout the world, we don't measure up. So we're spending more, getting less. So we've kind of, in a sense, proven that it's not how much money you spend. We've got to be more efficient at what we're doing. It's kind of another way of looking at this issue.
Yeah. We need to be more efficient and more effective. You know, we need to get the right result the first time. We need to be high quality. And as you point out, you know, we have some wonderful, wonderful providers in this country. But when you look at the total bottom line, our life expectancy is not as good as other countries. And our record at patient safety and quality is, frankly, not that great. You know, thousands of people die due to medical errors. And it's not untrained physicians. It's mostly related to information, once again. Some medications, for example, might have a five-syllable name, you know, a big, long, complicated name. And there might be another medication that very similar, all but one syllable maybe is the same. One of them has a standard dosage of 10 milligrams and the other one 10 micrograms, 1,000 times different. And if you prescribe the wrong one, somebody dies or can die. And unfortunately, this happens to thousands of people every year. So we have, in addition to the cost problem, we definitely have patient safety and quality problems.
In the last 10 years, there's been certainly a movement by the government to ask and, well, actually pay physicians to adopt electronic medical records in an attempt to have more intercommunicability. We, in our office, have had a medical record since 94. We made a change several years ago to a better one. But I still have, well, I now can interact with the hospitals. I can see x-ray reports online. So we're making some headway. But what I'm hearing you say also is that I think if I read your book correctly, it's more than that. We need to have a whole change in attitude that's more consumer-oriented, better towards health, and once we start doing that, we would improve things. So it suggests to me our incentives in healthcare are not aligned towards the consumer as well as you would like to see them.
That's exactly right. If I may, let me comment on your point about the electronic health records.
Sure.
I would agree with you that we are making some progress, but it's not great progress. You know, when you look at how Amazon works, and then you look at how the electronic health record patient portals work, what a difference. And, you know, this is because, as I mentioned earlier, we don't have standards. It's also because, frankly, the software isn't very good. You know, it's mostly based on old, 30-year-old mainframe solutions. It's not new. You know, it's legacy software. It's been around forever with a new wrapper on it to look like it's a web-based tool, but most of them are not very good, and they're incompatible. And patients don't like them because the doctor's busy with their face in the laptop, and doctors don't like electronic health records because they feel like they've become a data entry clerk. It doesn't have to be that way. When you consider other technologies, it can and should be really simple to do. The doctor should be able to talk to you in the office, and the electronic health record should be able to pick that up, literally pick up those words and parse those words into various values, you know, clinical values, and put them in the electronic health record. The doctor shouldn't have to be a data entry clerk. Right. So we can do a lot better, and I agree we're making progress on it, but it needs to go a lot faster, especially the interoperability between the different healthcare systems. Now, there are 250 software vendors that make this software, and there's no question that effective collaboration between physicians leads to better health. And alternatively, you know, poor communications can lead to mistakes and unfortunately can lead to mortality.
Let me take just a second. I always get distracted by my interest in the topic and forget to let our listeners know how they can get in touch with us. And I want to remind our listeners we're talking with Dr. John Patrick about his book, Health Attitude, Unraveling and Solving the Complexities of Healthcare. An excellent book if you want to really get a good feeling about some of the problems in healthcare and a somewhat different approach to how we go about making the improvements. We're in the middle of talking about these things now. If you've got questions or comments about your experiences or want to ask John a question, our local number again, 550-8433, 550-8433. Our toll-free number, 1-888-353-5752. And our email address, line1@alaskapublic.org. You need to spell that out, LINEONE at alaskapublic.org. I find that the electronic medical records that I've been involved with seem to help everything immensely better than my interaction with the patient. So I'm echoing what you just said about this interaction with a patient, and it seems to slow me down. It seems to make it more difficult, and I do feel like I spend much more time in managing charts rather than managing patients. The scheduling is easier. The billing and collection is easier. Finding charts are easier. Getting information from hospitals is now somewhat easier. And I can read other people's charts. I'm interested in how we can cause that interaction with the patient to be a little bit easier to get into the record.
You know, if you think about Skype, which is an internet service that allows people to talk over the internet. They now have a service at Skype that uses what's called real-time translation service. What that means is, let's suppose I'm Italian and you're German, and I speak to you in Italian, you hear it in German, and you reply to me in German, but I hear it in Italian, translated on the fly. Right. So we're talking to each other in two different languages, no problem.
Right.
So I mention that for the simple reason that if you can do that, why couldn't we make electronic health record software really, really easy to the point where a physician is talking to you, well, let's see, John, I noticed that your blood pressure the last time you were here was 128/85. And I see that today your temperature is this, and your weight was that, and you're having a dialogue, a conversation where we're having eye contact. Right. And all the things that you say that have clinical meaning are picked up by a tiny little microphone and software that can understand your voice, take those words, figure out what they mean, and put them in the electronic health record. Yeah, we can do that. That's why I call my book Health Attitude. You know, it's not health technology problems or health technology solutions. A lot of this is attitude. We have to be able to imagine these kind of solutions, and we have to have leadership in place to make it happen. And frankly, this is an area where I think the government should have an iron fist, not to set the standards or to control it, but to require that if you receive any money from the government, and just about all doctors and providers do, then you must use software that follows standards. And you, the vendors, have to get in the room, and I'm going to lock the door. You don't get out until you agree on those standards. That would be so huge. And again, it's not a technical problem. We know how to do this. It's an attitude problem.
And I get the idea when you say attitude that it's also an attitude that the consumer should be driving this interaction to please the consumer, as it happens in all other aspects of business. And right now, the incentives in healthcare are really for volume and seeing patients, not necessarily for decreasing volume and improving health and preventing illness.
No, exactly right. You know, the attitude thing, you know, the origin of that for me dates back 14 years ago when I wrote my first book, which was called Net Attitude. And it was about how to use the Internet and as a business or a hospital or any kind of an organization. And my premise was that the thing holding back organizations from getting the most out of the Internet, from really using it effectively, it was not technical problems. They were attitude problems, you know, not really getting it, you know, not understanding the consumer and how they use the Internet. So now in healthcare, you know, I feel we have the same thing. It's much more complex, however. The attitudes that need changed fall in four categories. I call it the four Ps: patients, providers, payers, and policymakers. So as patients, you know, we need to take more responsibility for our health. We need to gather more data ourselves about our health. We need to have a dialogue and collaborate with physicians and not sit there and have them tell us what's wrong and what to do about it. And providers have to change their attitude, too, especially hospitals. You know, under sort of the old way, hospitals get paid every time they do something, and they do a lot of things to a lot of people. And if they make a mistake in something they did, they get paid again. And if you get an infection while you're in the hospital, they get cure the infection they caused. It doesn't make sense to have that kind of a system. Whereas under the new model that you referred to as paying for value instead of paying for transactions, it's a different ballgame. The hospitals are going to receive a fixed amount, you know, so much per month per person. Now their attitude does a 180. Now they're having meetings in hospitals under the new system to discuss how can we keep people out of the hospital. Not because we're not going to treat them if they need it, but by understanding the population health that they're taking care of and reaching out into that little population. Maybe it's 10, 20, 30,000 people, and proactively, literally calling them and, you know, Mrs. Smith, how are you feeling? And, you know, we notice from our data that you haven't been to a cardiologist in quite some time. We urge you to go see your cardiologist. In other words, they don't want that patient to come to the ER and generate a lot of cost for the hospital when the hospital isn't going to get any more revenue.
Right.
So that's a big attitude change.
I want to come back to that. I think this is really important as well. We do have a phone call, and I want to take that call first, though. Ray, you're on line one?
Yes, I've always thought that it would be beneficial to require every test to be, the result of any test that's requested or given, be transmitted to a to a place in the cloud of my choice or emailed to me so I can keep it on my my own database. Right. So that when I go in to see my doctor, I have on a thumb drive or some address that I can provide on the cloud all the tests that I've recently had so he doesn't have to duplicate things. I should be my own, keeping my records should be up to me, and where I put them should be up to me, and making them available should be up to me, should be right. My responsibility.
So like I'm envisioning a repository on the cloud that you have access to, and you can allow access to it anytime you want it, and all the other information gets put in there. That's no problem. You just can control allowing people to get into that meta. Then is that something like what you're talking about?
That's what I'd like to see. And in other words, anytime I take a test, I give the address to where it's supposed to be deposited, right. And I'm the only one that has access, right. Or can provide others with access.
John, what about that?
Yeah, Ray, I couldn't agree with you more. surveys on this are very clear that people, a lot of people, feel like you do. However, the same survey given to doctors shows a different proportion. Some doctors actually believe that data is theirs, not yours. And, of course, it is yours. It's you're, one way or another, you're paying for it. It's your blood that got tested, and you deserve to have the results. And the Health and Human Services Department of our government would agree with you also, and, in fact, they have made it the law now that it is your data. But there's some, you know, the lawyers always find a way to put some exceptions into the legislation, and what it says is that you may have to make a written request to get it. They don't have to give it to you right away. They can take up to 30 days to get it to you, and you know, ridiculous things like that. But you know, there's light at the end of this tunnel. Some organizations are doing really a terrific job at this. It's not everywhere yet, but many health systems, if you get a blood test, you know, the next day at the latest, you'll have those results electronically. Not by email, it'll be put in the patient portal where you can log in and you can see it, and it's, you know, it's yours. Also, if you go to a provider like Quest, for example, you can sign up for, they have a service, it's called MyQuest. And just like any other website, you know, you log in and set up your preferences and so on. And when they do a blood test, it is automatically placed into their cloud. You can connect to it on an iPhone or an Android phone, and it's your data, and you get it quickly.
One other thing that I'd like to see is I recently went in to get a prescription for a ulcer issue that acid reflux, and the doctor that gave me the prescription initially, he retired, and so to get my prescription refilled, I had to go back in and pay another visit to another doctor, plus they want me to come back once a year to get this prescription filled. But the doctor that retired said, you know, there's really no reason to come in and see me. You're going to need this for the rest of your life. Just call my office anytime, and I'll refill the prescription. But then when he retired, that didn't apply anymore. And so I think some prescriptions should be for life, and I should be able to discuss it with my druggist as what changes I might want to take care of.
Mm-hmm.
I completely agree. But, you know, this is part of what Dr. Woodard and I were discussing a little bit ago, which is under the old model, doctors get paid every time they see you. Under the new model, a physician practice group or a hospital, they get a fixed revenue, and they got to cover all of their expenses with that. So they're going to be having meetings, and they're going to say, okay, team, let's decide that if somebody like Ray has a need for a particular medication and we know that it's an indefinite prescription, don't make them come in to renew it. Just renew it. And, you know, that's the way it should work. And there are a lot of things like that. You know, you're going to get a colonoscopy, but you got to come in first and watch a videotape of the procedure. You know, it's an extra visit. It's an extra inconvenience. It's an extra cost. All those extra things are going to be at least examined and hopefully, in most cases, eliminated.
All right. I'd love to see it. Thank you very much.
Yeah. Thanks. A very good point.
Yeah. From a medical standpoint, there are some immediate concerns I would have with what Ray was suggesting, but I don't think that's the important issue. The issue is how can we safely move to this value-based approach? And then the other thing I guess I'd like to say as a physician, we are pretty much trained and indoctrinated that we need to see some evidence of safety and effectiveness in particular. That's what the FDA requires of all new medications or therapies. There has to be safety and efficacy. And so I wonder how much of the apparent change of the healthcare system, and I'm thinking in a big, broad sense, is this waiting for evidence that this is going to be safe and effective. And as a physician, we see lots of things that look pretty good, only to never make it to the marketplace because of safety and efficacy findings with thorough testing, despite what appeared to be a wonderful new product. So I guess there's part of my skepticism and perhaps the general skepticism of the healthcare system that it's going to take a while to change.
Yeah, well, patient safety and quality is of the utmost importance. I mentioned earlier when I left IBM 14 years ago, I joined the board of a hospital. I can tell you back then, we never talked about patient safety and quality at the board level. Never. A few years into my board service there, a colleague of mine, a former board member, one day brought up the issue of an incident that had happened to a woman in the community that he knew, and it was a really terrible mistake that happened. And he looked around the room and he said, is anybody aware of this, that things like this happen? And he said, you know, this is our responsibility as a board. We should be talking about this. And from that point on, we did talk about it every single month. Mm-hmm. We went through the metrics with the chief medical officer. We went through the near misses that occurred in clinical treatments of various kinds. And now, under the Reform Act, there is a focus that was never there before on patient safety and quality, which results in tweaking the reimbursement of a hospital, in part based on their quality record. How many infections were caused in the hospital? How many ventilator-associated pneumonia cases were there? How many patients fell out of the bed? How many needle sticks were there? How many, and on and on and on. There's like 50 key metrics. And if you don't do a high-quality job, you're going to be penalized financially. This is a good thing. And it addresses your concern in part. It certainly addresses consumer concerns that, hey, these executives that are running this hospital, they're thinking about patient safety and quality. That's a good thing.
Let me remind listeners, you're listening to Line 1, your health connection. Our local number is 550-8433. Our toll-free number, 1-888-353-5752. Our email address, line1@alaskapublic.org. We're going to take a very short, about one-minute break, and then we'll continue our conversation with John Patrick on his book, Health Attitude. I'm Dr. Thad Woodard.
You're listening to Line 1 from Alaska Public Media. The program repeats tonight at 8 p.m. on KSKA Anchorage and will not be taking phone calls. You can find Line 1 on iTunes or listen at alaskapublic.org.
Welcome back. This is Line 1, your health connection from Alaska Public Media in Anchorage, Alaska, and I'm your host, Dr. Thad Woodard. Before I reintroduce today's guest and our topic, I do want to mention that the Anchorage medical community is somewhat saddened by the sudden, unexpected death of a local pediatrician, Dr. John Lyon. John had been a prominent member of the community ever since the mid-1970s and was truly instrumental in many of the local health care improvements. There's going to be a memorial service for Dr. Lyon this Wednesday at 3 p.m. at UAA's Wendy Williamson Auditorium for those of you wishing to pay respects to him and his family. Today on Line 1, we're discussing the book Health Attitude, Unraveling and Solving the Complexity of Healthcare with author John Patrick. In this book, he's enumerated many of the problems with our current healthcare system and suggests that change to the system focused on health and not illness is important, as well as rewarding value in our healthcare interactions, which he thinks can improve cost, access, and quality. You can email questions to us during the next 30 minutes or so that we're on the program at line1@alaskapublic.org. Our local number, if you'd like to call, is 550-8433, our toll-free number 1-888-353-5752. And please remember, you can always go to our archives at Line 1 alaskapublic.org, find the Line 1 link and listen to our archives or suggest someone listen to this program later. It'll be in our archives very shortly after today's program. Another issue, which I'm thinking about, I'm not sure maybe you did mention in your book. Well, I think you did. You got to talking about how hospital charges are discovered or are made and how they're found or how they're established and so forth. But it gets me to this issue of payment transparency and why that is such an unbelievably complex issue. I've heard insurance companies talk about the difficulties. I've heard hospitals talk about some of their contractual agreements, which make it very difficult, which is another thing that is distinctly different about healthcare to almost any other endeavor that I know of.
Yeah, absolutely right. I mean, just imagine going to Amazon.com and surfing around various products and things, and there's no prices. That's healthcare. Yeah. There's no prices. And, you know, that has to change. That's part of the attitude change that I wrote about in the book, Health Attitude. You know, it's so common sense when you think about it. I mean, why aren't those prices visible? And the reason is because nobody cared. You know, the patients, why did we care? So we weren't paying the bill. Somebody else was paying it. Now, of course, that's changing dramatically now with large deductibles. It used to be 5% of people had big deductibles. Now it's 40%, and they're really big deductibles. So everything's out of pocket, and people are saying, hey, doc, do I really need that MRI? That's expensive. And if the doctor convinces you that you do need it, then your follow-on question is, well, where can I get it? And the answer isn't, well, oh, down the hall. We have it. It's right here in part of our little group. No, I'm going to go to the Internet, and I'm going to search around and find out what the prices are. Now, it used to be impossible to do that. However, that's changing. One of the other aspects of the health reform is that providers that receive compensation from Medicare have to report the services they provided, whether it was a Medicare patient or not. They have to report to Medicare all of the things that they do and what the price was. And that's public data. And some very clever startup companies, Castlight is an example, castlight.com, they've built a little app where you can just put in your zip code and you can get the price of an MRI. And you'll find that it can range from $250 to $6,000. You can find a blood test can range from $100 to, believe it or not, $10,000 for the same test. So this is beginning to happen. California now requires all hospitals to put all their price lists on the Internet. This is a good thing. And so transparency of the pricing is going to cause the management of hospitals and providers to have to answer the question to the press and to their constituencies. You know, hey, why is our blood test 100 times the other guy's test? So So transparency is a key part of the health attitude change that we need.
Why hasn't that been more forthcoming?
Because there was no pressure on it. There was no reason. You know, it's just, you know, why would the hospital be motivated to make their price list public? You know, in other countries, it's that way. You go to a doctor in France, and it's like going to a Chinese restaurant. You see the price list on the wall. But here, there was our system. It's just we have an outdated system. The whole set of relationships, the way it works, it really doesn't make any sense that consumers aren't really treated like consumers. You know, it wasn't until the current reform that surveys are actually done now. Every patient that is discharged from a hospital gets a survey in the mail. I wish it was a SurveyMonkey online survey, but at least, you know, they get a survey, and it ranges from, you know, how was the food and was the noise bearable, but more important questions like, did the doctor explain to you what your diagnosis was in a way that you could understand it? And did you feel you got the opportunity to ask all the questions that you wanted to ask? And did the nurse tell you what medications they're giving you and what it's for? And so that's a change. That's another good thing. You know, there's a lot of bad things about the Health Reform Act, the Affordable Care Act. There's some things that need major surgery, and, you know, a lot of people are complaining about various aspects of it. But there's some pretty good things in there, such as these few that I've mentioned.
Yeah, I mean, it raises the question. I mean, the purpose of the Affordable Care Act, as I understand it, was to try to improve access. Which it's done. We're still the only country of the three of us in North America that doesn't have universal health insurance. But access was supposed to be improved, quality is supposed to be improved, and cost. Now, cost is not really changed, and the high deductible and the cost of health care seems to me to still be a limitation to access.
Well, yes and no. I mean, there are millions of people on the health care rolls that weren't there before. There's still 30 to 35 million that have no insurance, and lots of people die just because of that. But there are 9 or 10 million people that now have insurance, and it is affordable in the sense that they can afford the monthly premium. It can be as low as $1 a month in some states. It depends on what the subsidy is. But as you say, the large deductible is not affordable. I just saw a case the other day where a person had an income of $18,000. They were paying $1 a month for their health insurance, but their deductible was $4,500. Well, a person making $18,000 a year can't afford to spend $4,500. But they do get certain things without the deductible kicking in, such as a well baby examination, for example, or a checkup for the primary insured. So it's better than it was before. Let's put it that way. And it's going to take us a long time before we get things in balance to the point where it's affordable. I think it's a fair criticism to say, is the Affordable Care Act, you know, is health care really affordable? Well, for millions of people, it's not affordable. And people like to blame it on Obamacare, you know, that's the reason, that's the problem. But it really isn't. The problem is our cost is out of line. It's that $1.5 trillion of unnecessary tests and procedures. That's the problem.
Got another caller, John. Let's take her. Mary, you're on line one.
Hi.
How
can you hear me?
I sure can.
Okay. There are so many elements of this that I am concerned about, but one of them that I just wanted to comment on was the issue of security, and I feel that the burden of a lot of these issues is falling on the primary care or the provider, and it's not. It is a great idea that you could have it on the cloud or have it on a thumb drive. A patient portal is a good option because that's a secure network. But some of these other issues that are being put out there are really not secure. And the provider has to make sure that the way they're providing the information is in a secure manner. And the ramifications of not doing that are quite severe on their shoulders. And I just think that I wanted to bring that subject up, that the providers would probably welcome it a lot more. But I think that the rules and regulations out there around security are pretty scary. I mean, you know, pretty severe.
Mary, do you have an example of something that's not secure?
Well, a thumb drive. If somebody brings in all their information on a thumb drive and the provider is, you know, can you actually just take this thumb drive and stick it into your computer and have it be secure? If you're putting the information out there onto a website, is it secure? You know, there's so many cases of hacking. I basically think electronic health records, are, it's a great idea, but you have to take it with the understanding that there's a potential for it getting to the person, someone that you don't intend it to get to.
Right. Well, I mean, I couldn't agree with you more. Security is of the utmost importance. And I agree with you also that thumb drives are not secure. And frankly, thumb drives are a thing of the past. You know, the cloud is better and more secure than things that we carry around with us. And with the really good devices that we have these days to connect to the cloud, like iPhones and Android phones, you know, we really don't need thumb drives anymore. Websites that are other than patient portals, I would agree, it's not a good place to put your data. Patient portals are scrutinized very highly. They have good security techniques. Most of them have what's called a two-factor authentication, which means that it's not just your login and password, but it's a third thing. And that third thing can be a code that appears on your cell phone, and you type that code in. So that even if somebody were to steal your ID and your password, they still couldn't log in because they don't have that unique code that you have in your cell phone. Lastly, I would say that, and you mentioned this, that there is the possibility that there are going to be more breaches. Anthem Blue Cross had a horrible breach of their data. Unforgivable from my point of view. It was not rocket scientists that broke in. They were just hackers, and the system had extremely poor security, incredibly poor security for 80 million persons' health records. So, yeah, it's a risk, but, you know, we have to make it work. We have to keep raising the bar for security. We have to constantly inspect, test, and make sure that it is secure. And when I say we, I mean the healthcare industry needs to they can't just say, okay, well, we checked it, it's secure. No, they've got to continuously test and secure and try to break in, or hire somebody to break in if they can. And if they're successful, figure out how they did it and fix it. So, yeah, great point.
Thank you. Thank you. That was all. It just kind of scared me. I mean, I just want people to know that it's not that simple. It is. You have to be vigilant, and it's a very difficult process. So your provider may appear to be reluctant, but they're actually being prudent. That was all. Thank you.
Thank you, Mary. Listeners, this is Line 1, your health connection, originating from Anchorage, Alaska, Alaska Public Media. My guest today is Dr. John Patrick. He's got a Doctor of Health Administration. He was 35 years with IBM, ended as Vice President of Technology. He's written a book, Health Attitude, Unraveling and Solving the Complexities of Healthcare. It is a very good book if you're interested in really seeing an enumeration of all the problems. And you might understand or believe then that we're not quite as good of a healthcare system as we all think we are. And that's been borne out with some studies comparing our quality and certainly our cost across the world and especially the developed nations. If you want to ask John any questions or you have comments, let me give you a couple of more numbers here to go to in the next couple of minutes. 550-8433 is our local number, 550-8433. Our toll-free number, 1-888-353-5752, and our email address, line1@alaskapublic.org. John, the way my mind works is I'm always interested if we've got a problem is trying to figure out how we got to this problem with the idea that if we understand how we got there, we at least won't make the same mistake again, hopefully. And I keep right. looking back and thinking health insurance is completely different the way it was rolled out and used until fairly recently than all other insurance. Insurance was designed to help someone prevent from losing something they couldn't afford to lose. And yet we started with very low deductible, almost total, everything's covered. And that had to have something to do with how we were, the whole healthcare system, including physicians, labs, everybody, was incentivized to do things. So there was no incentive to decrease costs and keep people well. And I think they got us to this. Now we're trying to ratchet back deductibles and so forth in a way to kind of get back to the way the insurance should be. Is that right? And is that it need to be taken into account when we try to figure out how to get ourselves out of this mess?
Well, you know, you're not alone in raising the question about the health insurance companies. You know, a lot of people think they're the enemy, you know, that they won't pay for what I need, or they're too expensive, or they have these big deductibles, or they're bureaucratic, or there's a long list of complaints. And, you know, I could add to that list myself. But if you take a high-level view of this, I mean, what is insurance? How does it work? Well, the way it works is if you're the insurer, you make an estimate of what your costs are going to be. And those costs are going to be what the doctors charge, what the drugs cost, what the procedures and tests and so on. That's the cost, plus the administrative cost of putting it all together. And then you set a premium that's designed to recover that cost plus some profit. Because if you don't have some profit, then you go out of business. You don't exist. You can't help anybody. So that's what the insurance is. So the problems that people see, the high deductibles, the high premiums, it used to cover this, but it doesn't cover it anymore. All those problems come from one single root cause, and that is the total cost of healthcare is too high. It's been growing rapidly. Right now, drug costs, for example, are rising at double digits. The healthcare industry is putting up with the TV advertising of drugs directly to consumers. That's $5 billion spent to put 15 advertisements in front of us every day. Does that add to the American health, America's health? No, it doesn't. That's a whole topic in itself. But the core problem is the cost. Mm-hmm. If the cost wasn't so high and wasn't rising so rapidly, then the insurance wouldn't be such a visible thing to blame.
So we need to revamp our payment reform and how we're doing things and change the attitude towards health is what you're saying.
Yeah, and we need to get the cost down. Right. So why is the cost so high? Well, we've talked about the unnecessary tests and procedures, $1.5 trillion. That's the biggest part. We have fraud. It's on the order of between $50 and $100 billion a year. That's being addressed, but it's complicated and it's hard to eliminate, although they're making progress. Then we have inefficiency. You know, the way, you know, just again, think about Amazon. You click and the package is on your doorstep the next day. In healthcare, you fill out a piece of paper, you fax it to somebody, and then you get a phone call, and then you get a letter, and then somebody has to call this person and then fax another approval form. And it's just it's mind-numbing to a technologist
to see how things happen in healthcare. It's amazing that anything gets done because it's so inefficient. So if we can make it more efficient, if we can collaborate through electronic health records to eliminate unnecessary tests and procedures, if we can change the reimbursement system, that'll drive the cost down. And if the cost comes down, then the insurance comes down too.
All right. There are some efforts being made. There's some successes out there in changing things, using patient-centered medical home and so forth, and accountable care organizations. I don't know that we'll have time to get to those, but because I do have a couple of callers I want to get to, but I wanted to throw those words and ideas out there. Debbie, you're on line one.
Hi. Thanks for taking the call. As a consumer, I have a couple of thoughts. One is that improving the efficiency is really welcome and to get the costs down, but I'm uncomfortable with comparing the delivery of healthcare to Amazon.com. We need to remember that we're not commodities, we're humans. And towards that end, I just wonder what impact voice-activated software being used in a consultation between a physician and a patient is going to have. That seems like not a good idea. Are you going to task the physician with making a decision about when to use that and when to not, when not to? Those are my topics, and I'll hang up and wait to see what the response is.
Okay. All right, Debbie. Thanks for the call.
Yeah, well, very, very good points. You know, I feel Amazon, you know, that's just one of many great websites that are responsive to consumers, It's convenient for consumers. There's no reason that healthcare can't be responsive and be convenient. You know, telehealth, for example, is going to add convenience to the world of healthcare. Cleveland Clinic now has a $49 consult. So in other words, you go to their website and you are guaranteed that within 1 minute you will be face-to-face, online, video, with a certified provider. It might be a physician, it might be a physician's assistant or a nurse practitioner, for $49. You know, that's a cost-effective way to deliver, you know, human-based care. As far as voice dictation, you know, that's really a great technology, and you know, we'll take that for granted at some point. That when we're having a conversation with our doctor, it's not eavesdropping; it's an automation of the process of getting the important clinical facts from that conversation recorded into an electronic health record. You know, what's happening in emergency rooms across the country is the use of scribes. A scribe, in other words, a person sitting in the corner, so the doctor doesn't have to enter into a laptop because they're helping, they're treating you, you know, while you're there in the emergency department, and somebody else is recording all this information. I mean, is that a good way to do it, to have a third party there who may or may not make mistakes in entering the data? And do we need to have another person know all the details of our health in addition to our own doctor? You know, so voice recognition and other technologies are really going to make healthcare more human-like, more responsive, more efficient, and more convenient.
Got one more caller, just a couple of minutes. Kevin, you're on line one. What can we do for you?
Well, thank you, Thad. This is Kevin, and I'd like to know about how insurance companies establish their usual, customary, and reasonable charges. And I apologize for making a specific question about this, but recently my wife was treated by folks at an institute, and all of the doctors in Alaska, or in Anchorage anyway, are part of this institute. So when there's only one price being charged, how could the insurance company come up with a number, a price, that's different than the usual, customary, and reasonable when there is no other price to compare it to?
Yeah, well, insurance companies have a lot of data. They have more data than our doctors do. And when I say data, I mean data about us. You know, they
They know more about us than our doctor does because they pay for a lot of different procedures and tests and medications, and they have all that data. And they use it in a way to establish what they're going to pay for and how much they're going to pay for it. And they look at not just at us, but they look at people across the whole country. And they have this enormous amount of data, and then they make judgments. And those judgments are supported by physicians who are employed by the insurance company. Sometimes they make policy decisions that we don't like. I mean, all of us have had situations. I certainly have, and we all have, that something they wouldn't pay for that we feel they should pay for. They made a policy decision based on data that they have, and as I say, they employ a lot of physicians to help them make those decisions. I don't want to sound like I'm defending health insurance companies. I mean, I think they make a lot of mistakes, I think, from a policy perspective, and some of them are enormously profitable, and they're the people that run the companies. But all in all, it's a good system because it does spread the risk across a large base of people.
All right, Kevin, we're about to run out of time. I appreciate your call. John, we're in the last couple of minutes. Give us an overview. What are the things you want to make sure we come away from the program remembering?
Well, I think we should be optimistic about healthcare. There are a lot of problems. We've talked about quite a few of those during our discussion here. And, you know, they need to be fixed, and we should bug our Congress people to do the right things. But there are good things happening, too. And there's a better focus on patient safety and quality, number one. The reimbursement system is changing. And the cost per person is actually beginning to decline. The reason the total cost of healthcare is still going up is because every day 10,000 people turn 65 and join Medicare. And, you know, we just can't afford to have it that way. We've got to get the cost per person reduced. We can do this through working on the fraud. We can do it through this concept of accountable care, which provides a fixed cost to providers to take care of us and focus on our health, not just treat our sicknesses. That's showing early signs that that's going to work. It's going to take a few years, but I'm quite optimistic about it. And we should take advantage of the many tools that are available as consumers. You know, you can get for $75, you can get an attachment for your iPhone, and you can take a 30-second EKG. You can take an EKG every day if you want, or every hour for that matter. And there are a lot of tools like that coming into the market that will allow us to gather data about our health, which enables us to have a more thorough conversation with our doctor and collaborate and participate in development of a diagnosis and a treatment plan. So I wrote about all these things in my book, Health Attitude, and you can find all about it at healthattitude.org. That's one word, healthattitude.org.
John, thanks very much for taking the time today. We appreciate it.
It was a pleasure.
If you want to continue the conversation on healthcare, you can join KSK on Facebook. Join host Penis Pemberton next Monday, November 30th at 2 p.m., when the topic is navigating divorce without significant effects on the children. Pat Yak is Chief Content Officer at Alaska Public Media. Dave Waldron was our audio engineer today. I'm Dr. Thad Woodard. Have a really great day.
Line 1 is a production of Alaska Public Media, which is solely responsible for its content. Views expressed are those of the host and participants and do not reflect the underwriters or KSKA. Learn more about Line 1 and listen online at alaskapublic.org. Life Informed. This is Alaska Public Media.